I've told many people over the years, if you get, for the price is right, 70-ohm hard line, CATV cable, half-inch, three-quarter-inch, 7/8-inch, whatever, beautiful stuff. Putting connectors on the end of it if you don't have the right kind of a stinger connector, and if you're not smart enough in making good mechanical connections.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock, WQVL, repeater system.
Putting connectors on the end of the CATV hard line is a little bit of a pain. But once you solve that problem, that cable has got extremely low loss. And it's got much lower loss than anything else you're likely to use. If you've got a 50-ohm antenna and a 50-ohm transmitter, and you put 70-ohm cable between the two, and you do no correcting of any kind, that's a 1.5 standing to wave ratio, which gives you an extra 2/10 of a dB of loss. But that length of 70-ohm cable might be a decibel lower in loss than anything else you can put your hands on that you can afford. It's about 8/10 of a dB ahead in that example. And people ask me, how do you solve the problem of putting 70-ohm cable in a 50-ohm system? And from time to time, I've told them, half-joking, that you put a piece of copper, you put a piece of paper tape alongside of the 70-ohm cable, and you write across it 50 ohms. And you make sure that side of the tape always faces toward the rig. The rig will never know the difference. Your antenna is most likely, can easily have a 1.5 ISWAR. Why worry about the 1.5 ISWAR of the cable? If it's a low-loss quality cable that you can get free of charge if you know where the right stocking yard is for the cable TV system in your neighborhood. So you'd be amazed how many people have turned their nose up against when they came across an opportunity to get a hold of some of that really good cable. And that was foolish. You're listening to a piece of 70-ohm cable from me for the last 27 years. This piece of cable coming from the back of my rig right now is a 70-ohm piece of cable going up the tower to a Yagi antenna that's aimed at the Glen Oaks repeater. You're listening to a piece of 70-ohm cable. I've probably got 1,200 feet of it being used around my yard on various antennas. The price is right, and that 70-ohm CATV hardline is made for direct burial. You can bury it in the ground for the next 20 years. You try to do that with any other kind of cable you can get your hands on, and it may not survive. Stuff is really rugged. Okay, I wonder if... So, I think we've sort of answered your question, Rich, but if not, let me turn it back to you to be sure. KC2LTY, KQIYW.
Alright, so what I'm understanding is if you use 70-ohm coax or 50-ohm coax, the radio and the antenna, it doesn't make a difference. You can use 70-ohm coax, and like you've been doing for whatever years, and it works fine, correct?
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to give you an example of where you might get into a little bit of trouble. When you have a particular length of 70-ohm cable, if the length of 70-ohm cable is an exact multiple of a half wavelength, one half wavelength, one wavelength, one and a half wavelength, 41 and a half wavelength, if it's an exact multiple of a half wavelength, then the input impedance and the output impedance are equal to each other. Even though it's 70-ohm cable, it will act like 50 ohms when it's loaded with 50 ohms. That's if it's a half wavelength or a multiple long. If it's a odd number of quarter wavelengths long, one quarter wave, three quarter wave, five quarter wave, then you get this funny thing called impedance inversion. So there is a slim possibility where if your antenna happens to be a particular phase angle of a 1.5 standing wave ratio, and it's a 50-ohm antenna with a 1.5 standing wave ratio of a particular phase angle, and you have an odd number of wavelengths of 70-ohm cable, the 70-ohm cable all by itself would give you a 1.5 ISWAR, and you combine the two in the worst-case situation, you can end up with 1.5, 1.5 combined, and the combination ends up as a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And if your particular transmitter is so persnickety that anything above a 1.8 standing wave ratio, it cuts itself back into self-protect mode and doesn't put out full power. There's a slim chance you can run into that problem. But if you did, all you'd have to do is add an extra quarter wavelength of cable in that system, 70 ohm cable, and the problem would go away. So even if you had that problem, there's a rather simple solution to it. So there is a slight risk of putting 70 ohm cable into a 50 ohm system and getting a slightly aggravated condition. But 90 some odd percent of the time, the 70 ohm cable is so rugged, so weatherproofed, so low in loss, so inexpensive, to not use it would be really foolish. It's great stuff. Don't turn it down. K2LIW listening. Over to you, Rich, if you've got any further comments on this.
In other words, if you get the chance, yank it off the telephone poles.
All you've got to do is go to the stockyard where they stock the stuff, your local cable company. They buy it in 5,000-foot reels. When the 5,000-foot reel gets down to the 150-foot level, they stop using that reel. They won't continue that run down the block because they have to put in a splice, and they don't trust splices. They don't trust their inexpensive personnel to properly do a good job of installing a splice where it doesn't give them grief downrange. So when there's 150 feet or so left on the end of the reel, they stop using that reel, and they bring that reel back to the stockyard. You visit that stockyard, and you'll probably see 10 reels with anywhere from 100 to 200 feet of cable on it. You get friendly with the guy who runs the stockyard. There's a chance he will give you one of those reels free of charge. If he charges you a nuisance fee of $15 to take away one of those reels, take him up on it. If you look at the Andrew Heliacs that you and I can buy, Rich, and you compare the dollars versus insertion loss, that 70-ohm hardline cable is worth a dollar and a half a foot. And you can get 150 feet of it for $15 if he feels like charging you a nuisance charge to take it away. And then for you to take the reel apart by taking apart the four bolts, and you take off the two ends of the reel and take out the barrel staves of wood that's in the middle, and in your hand will be this beautiful coiled hardline chunk of cable. And the price is right. To you, it's worth a dollar and a half or $2 a foot. And in the stockyard, they got a whole lot of it that you'd be amazed how many guys who have made a deal and ended up with a piece of half-inch, three-quarter-inch, seven-eighths-inch, inch-and-a-quarter. They've always got chunks of that stuff left over that they think they can't use, and they eventually sell it as scrap at 25 cents a pound or some crazy number like that. Over to you, Rich. KC2LTY, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, I copy that. Understood. I gotta see what I can find. Answer my question. Thank you.
And while you're there, if you pick up half-inch, three-quarter-inch, seven-eighths, or whatever, ask him if he has any used stinger connectors for that cable. The connectors that they make for the end of the cable, the so-called stinger connector, is made to go from the cable to the box that they put up on the telephone pole. The utility box that contains the amplifier, the breakout cable that goes to your house, whatever. That connector is a beautiful, weatherproof, mechanically strong thing that has on the end of it that goes into the box a 5/8 24 thread, which is the identical thread on the back of a UG21 Type N connector. So with a little bit of physical adapting, you can install the stinger connector on the end of their hardline cable. Then you can install a Type N male cable connector on the end of their stinger connector. And now you've got a beautiful mechanical combination with weatherproof seals and the whole works, a nice mechanical strength to it. So ask them if they've got some used stinger connectors. Quite often when they're doing any service to a system, they take off the old connectors and throw them into a box. Unless they get really desperate, they don't reuse the used connectors. Well, there's nothing wrong with the used connectors. You take it apart, you take out the metal chips that are in there, clean it up a little bit, put some new silicon grease on the rubber seal, put it back together, and they're good for another 25 years, if you know what I mean. Again, the price is right, even if you got to buy them. So a hell of a lot of people have gotten hundreds of feet of this cable free of charge. A friend I know wanted to take me up on this deal. He visited his local stockyard in upper New York State somewhere, and they wanted to charge him $10. and the guy turned down the deal for 200 feet of cable. They wanted to charge him $10. He knew that a friend of his down in Long Island got the same kind of cable free of charge. And therefore, the $10 stuck in his craw. I told him, you go back to that guy, you apologize to him, and you hand him $20 and take away the cable. The stuff is worth $1.50 a foot. He was about to give you $300 worth of it, and you turned it down because he wanted to charge you $10. That's penny-wise, pound-foolish. You see where I'm going on this one. K2RAW, any other comments?
I copy everything, Dick. Thank you very much. Stinger connectors. All right, very good. Thank you.
And by the way, when it comes to the cable itself, the vocabulary they use will confuse you. The half-inch diameter cable, they call it 500. The three-quarter inch diameter cable, they call it 750. The 7/8 inch diameter cable, they call it 875, because it is 0.875 inches in diameter. So the diameter in thousands of an inch is what they call the cable. You ask them for three-quarter inch cable, they say, what the hell are you talking about? You ask them, hey, do you guys have any 750 cable? And they say, yeah, we got the 1,000 feet of it over there on five separate reels. The cable, the mill ends that were left over when the last time we did an installation of cable TV down the block a couple miles away. So you got to use their vocabulary. Stinger connectors, 750 or 875 or 1.25 for the inch and a quarter and so on. They probably call it 1250. Okay, anybody with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters. K2RAW.
Let me answer where I want. Yeah, I have a question on a VCR problem I just encountered recently. Want to handle something like that?
Yeah, I just suddenly realized that we didn't pick up Bernie. Bernie, K2IO, I hope we didn't put you to sleep. K2IO, K2RAW.
K2RAW.
Eric recognized. Bernie, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here, but my comment was on the last subject, so it's a pass at this point. K2IO.
Well, let me pick up Eric, because usually he's got something that we shouldn't ignore with reference to the repeater. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a favor of you. At some appropriate moment in a little while, would you be so kind to listen to the input of 375 and see if you hear anything?
WHYY, I know what the answer is.
Go right ahead, Rich.
Your station that's around the corner, I guess it's within about a mile of my house. I heard that about 3 hours ago. I should have mentioned something on here. That EchoLink transmitter is locking up your cell phone repeater. It locks it up till it times out. That guy's going to be very unhappy because it gets back to his radio, because it hits me with a 20 over S9 at my house.
That's what I figured. It's been like that last night, and I haven't had a chance to call anybody, but I'll call N2SGU and see if you can turn that thing off.
Yeah, right now 375 seems to not be on the air.
That's because it's timed out. I listen to it carefully with my volume up all wet, and he's got his microphone locked on because I could hear voices or other noises in the house while this thing was going on.
Yeah, no, I've been able to drop the controller, but, you know, there's a signal there. I didn't think it was repeated, but I wanted to make sure.
Oh, you wanted me to listen on the input frequency, not the output frequency. Is that true, Rich? I mean, Eric?
That's correct, Dick.
Stand by. I'll do it right now. I'm hearing a beautiful signal on the input. Nice and loud. And like you said, it's somebody's stuck microphone. I'm hearing noises of somebody's house. Over to you, Eric.
All right, thank you. I'm going to make a couple phone calls. Continue on with...
LTY, one more question.
Go ahead, Rich.
You ever seen coax cable with aluminum shielding?
That's what we call hardline. Over to you, Rich.
How do you solder that to a PL 59?
You don't. The so-called stinger connector is a collet mechanism. In other words, when you properly core out the end of the cable, the foam, the white expanded foam, that's the dielectric, you properly core it out, either with a coring tool, or if you're a little bit skilled, you use your Swiss Army knife, and you install the stinger connector. The stinger connector has got an inner ferrule that grabs the inner edge of the outer connector, outer conductor. It has another set of jaws on the outside of the outer conductor, and it squeezes down on those drawers and captures that aluminum sheath. And there's a rubber O-ring there, so it mechanically digs its jaws into that outer aluminum jacket and provides a rubber O-ring seal. That's what the Singer connector does. You don't solder to that aluminum. You don't stand a chance. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but too damn difficult. You'd be melting down the foam in the process. That Singer connector is made to go on the end of that cable, mechanically give you a very good joint and a very good weatherproof. Over to you, Rich.
Okay, so it's crimped on, in other words.
Absolutely not. It is not a crimp. It is a collet mechanism. It's got an inner ferrule that supports the aluminum outer jacket so that the aluminum outer jacket doesn't have the ability to decrease itself in diameter. It's got a set of jaws on the outside of the aluminum outer jacket that squeeze down on it when you tighten up the nut on the Singer connector. So it's a collet mechanism that grabs onto the outside of that cable and really hangs on like no tomorrow, and provides that rubber seal that gives you a weather seal, gives you a beautiful connection on the end of that cable. For you and I to remanufacture some kind of a mechanical assembly to do what that Singer connector does would be very difficult. Do whatever you got to do to get a hold of those Singer connectors. Over to you, Rich.
Well, is this something like, in plumbing terms, like a 3/8 piece of copper with a nut and ferrule, when you tighten a nut, the ferrule crushes against the copper?
What you're describing is a compression fitting. It is not a compression fitting. It is closer to being a flare fitting. A flare fitting, although the outer conductor of the copper tubing has to be flared out, ignore that for a minute, but the flare fitting supports the copper tubing on the inside and on the outside and squeezes between the two. I wonder if that makes sense, Rich. Go ahead.
Yes, it makes sense. I know how flare fittings work. It's in between the inside and the outside. The aluminum will be jammed in between the two.
I think somebody's trying to get on the IRLP.
Okay, Rich, you got it right. Somebody else would like to join us? Give me your call letters right now.
K6DPZ. I just want to make a comment. Was he talking about hardline 3/8 or a quarter? Or what's diameter? He may be talking about coax, which is 75 ohm, which is used for television, or used crimp-on connectors, Dick.
Hal, you've got to be kidding. I don't believe what I just heard. You're telling me somebody on planet Earth is using a crimp connector outdoors on aluminum hardline cable? I won't say it's impossible, but boy, I'm very skeptical. Over to you, Hal.
My comment, Dick, was, did he say it was large hardline, or is it just 75 ohm, like RG59 cable that they use for CATV that they're trying to use for a dipole? He didn't say the diameter of the cable he was using, or I missed it.
Okay, this is a complicated discussion that's been going on for the last half hour. I wonder how much of it you've heard, Hal. Go ahead.
Is that safe?
I just tuned in on it. That's why I was wondering when he said, you know, copper aluminum shield on a cable. That's why I made the comment, Dick. Go ahead.
Okay, you're unfortunately getting quite a misunderstanding. We're talking about 750 hardline cable, 3/4 inch, or 7/8 inch hardline cable, 875 as they call it, and the use of the proper Singer connector for the end of the cable. And we're talking about the mechanism of capture of the Singer connector. That is the subject of discussion. I wonder if it makes a little more sense now, Hal. Go ahead.
Now I understand what you're saying. I understand completely, Dick. I came in on just listening to it, and I was thinking to myself, what's this guy using, 75 ohm cable for a dipole, which he could have gotten, you know, very cheap cable that does have aluminum on it. I know they could use a crimp-on connector with an adapter if you're really in a problem. That's my only comment, Dick. And also, one other thing before I get out of here. Did you ever get the 8640B down where you wanted it, 455?
I haven't made that modification yet, and that was a very interesting discussion about that signal generator that you and I had. But now, run that by again. Is there anybody that you know of who has a qualified, high reliability, crimp-on connector that they use on 3/4-inch CATV hardline in an outdoor environment? Are you really talking about a crimp-on connector? I'm very skeptical of that. Go ahead.
Not on that size hardline. I thought he had 75-ohm cable, and it was with aluminum, which they put F, they crimp F connectors on. I've seen some hams use that going to a dipole and then use an adapter in back of their rig. That was my comment, Dick.
Okay, now I'm going to agree with you. When it comes to RG59, RG6 type cable, flexible 70-ohm type cable where you put an F connector on it, yes, those connectors are crimp type. And most of the time they're used indoors, although occasionally outdoors. But when it comes to real hardline cable, I don't think anybody's made a crimp connector for that. At least I hope they haven't. I wouldn't trust it. Alrighty. Let's see now. Did we go back to Bernie? I don't think we gave you a chance. Bernie, I think you were worried that you had a subject that changed. You're allowed to change the subject. KQYO, KQYW.
No. I've forgotten whatever my comment was at this point. It was one of the previous subjects, and you had called for comments, and I was in line to comment, but then Rich switched us over to hardline. So anyway, my comment's null and void at this point. Back to wherever the conversation is, K2YO.
Doesn't matter if it's two subjects back, Bernie. You're allowed to make a comment or ask a question at this time. Go right ahead.
Dick, I'm trying to politely say I've gotten too old to remember what the comment was. Hi.
Wow. Don't tell me you got CRS also. I thought I'm the only guy with that. Can't remember stuff. That's what it stands for. Maybe then I'll tell you another. Okay. I think we've gone through the list of people who signed in. And maybe there's some brand new subjects that we should be discussing. If so, give me your call letters and your name at this time. KQIW.
Okay, here, Dick.
Go right ahead, Eric.
All right. I think we've cleared up the problem. Now it's just a matter of getting things back together here. I guess you've timed the IRLP out on this. So if we stand by a second, let me hook back up.
And Dick, it's K6DPC. The other comment I had, the only connectors I use with hardline are Andrews, 73.
Auto connect enabled.
KC2FGU.
Welcome to the New England Reflector, 912,
Channel 6.
All right, Dick, continue.
I am curious, what was required to eliminate that signal on 375?
A phone call. I haven't gotten a return phone call, but obviously somebody dropped it.
I am curious how you knew who to call.
Actually, I'm getting my return phone call right now. Hang on.
Okay. KC2FCU, I think it was. Start off with your name, sir, and then your question or comment. My name is Dick, K2RIW. FCU, you got it. Maybe I heard the call letters incorrectly. Is there somebody who had a set of call letters who just signed in that sounded like KC2FCU? Go right ahead. Okay. Anyone out of area want to sign in to the Long Island TechNet? This is K2RIW, listening.
Nobody's logged in, so don't bother. Just continue on.
Okay. I think we've answered all the questions of people who signed in tonight. I'm going to turn it over to Mel and see if he's got any exciting chunks of airmail, email that we should be handling. Over to you, Mel. And by the way, Mel, when it comes to that Lansdorfer antenna, I hope you got that nice article that I went through a whole bunch of rigmarole, finally got a hard copy of it, even though it's the latest issue of Antennas and Propagation Journal that it's in. Very nice article in Lansdorfer, and it sounds like it's got an awful lot of capability. Last Wednesday or so, I mailed that to you. I hope you got it. If not, I have to send it to a better email address than the one that I used. KC2KEY, K2RIW.
And WS2N is still checking in.
Very good, Paul. Glad to hear from you. Let me pick up Mel first, and then we'll he's going to give us a quick rundown, and then we'll go to your space report. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, I was going to mention this to you. I saw that you sent me the information on the Lansdorfer. I clicked onto it. It just started to come up in gibberish. It just didn't make any sense. And no matter what I did, it was just looked like you were doing it in hieroglyphics or something, Dick. I just couldn't make out what the heck happened. Because I did see you email me, and when I clicked on to open it, it just went crazy. I just can't imagine what had happened, Dick. Over.
Okay, let me first check. Did I use the right email address for you, or did I use one that's a little bit more circuitous, if you know what I mean? Over to you, Mel.
Oh, I got it. No doubt, I got it. No problem at all. K2KEYARR.net, I guess. Lots of emails, and seldom find anything, that I can't get the info out of it. It's just that this was very unusual, Dick, that something just went crazy with the whole thing. Over.
Okay. So maybe it's something to do with the fact that... let me drop long enough. Was there somebody out of area signing in? Okay. I've got a Linux-based system in my house, and sometimes there's a communication problem between Linux systems and Windows systems. Maybe what I'll do is I'll convert the document into a PDF document and then resend it to you. Maybe that'll end the problem. But it's a very nice Lansdorfer article. I wanted you to have it. You'll enjoy it. You're probably not an IEEE AP member. If you're a member of the IEEE, and if you're also a member of the Antennas and Propagation Society, you have free access to the so-called Explore files of the IEEE. Ordinarily, it costs you $350 a year to be a member of Explore, which allows you to go back to all of their past articles and get a hard copy online. So I, being an IEEE AP member, have access to the AP articles, and therefore I'll convert it to something more compatible to your system and resend it. But I think you will discover that the Lansdorfer technique of building a Yagi, among other kinds of antennas, but Yagi is the one that's favored in this particular article, looks to me like it's got a lot to offer. Gives you a lot more gain for the number of elements. Back to you for any comments on that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. PDF files usually have no problem with. I've never seen a problem of you telling me that your system will not cross over to a Windows-based, even the... the Windows Professional, Dick, is that what you assume, or is that really a factor? Because I've never heard this before. Over.
It's a little bit rare, but depending on who I'm talking to, occasionally they will get a gibberish enclosure from me. Not quite sure what happens, but it does happen. I can mail it to my Windows system at the salt mine. I have no trouble opening it. But each Windows system is a little bit difficult. And for all we know, in the process of it flowing through the ARRL website, which does do a malware function search, maybe it got confused there. I'm not quite sure what all happened. The email address I used for you, I presume that's your favorite one. That is your main one that most people use. Is that true, Mel?
Yeah, Roger. Everyone sends me emails. Let's see, this week, about 70 emails. And whatever ones that I choose to, you know, open to look at, no problem whatsoever. Never had anybody so far. This is going through literally thousands. God knows how many thousands I've gone through in the last years with this. And so far, no problem whatsoever. I have never heard of Linux and a problem that with Linux and a Windows XP type based programming, that there's a crossover problem. I can't see why there should be anything wrong, except maybe, like you say, because it's passing through the ARRL. But I thought the ARRL is just a mail drop over.
It's a little more than that. They do a malware search, virus. They do a virus search, and I think they will not pass on the emails that contain virus. Now, I'm guessing that the average person that wants to write you an email guesses that you are an ARRL member, and therefore you can send your call letters ARRL.net. Other than that, I've done all kinds of searches to the KCRC and whatever, also QRZ.com. The average person who doesn't make that guess, what is the procedure by which they find out your email address? You're a little bit, not an easy guy to get an email address for if you didn't make the guess that you're an ARRL member and listed yourself with ARRL. How about you, Mel?
Oh, well, listed all over that way. I guess anybody that has requested it, of course, I've mentioned it God knows how many numerous times here on the TechNet, and also on our 10-meter net, our 2-meter net. And so anybody in the way of ham radio operators that wanted to send me any info or questions have never had a problem. Also, like I say, I don't know whether or not I would, yeah, I believe that the ARRL most likely is just looking for viruses, but I don't think that in any way or form that they do other than look for viruses, because thrown in with that is many times there is spam, no doubt, that I see the spam coming through with a lot of the emails that have nothing to do with amateur radio, Dick. So I didn't think that they, you know, they did that much more in scrutinizing other than maybe I could say viruses over.
Okay, one other question. As I search every nook and cranny I can find within the Kings County Radio Club website, am I correct in guessing that your email address is not listed there? Is that true?
No, there may be a problem there. They may have, something is, the there's a whole system there and all has to be gone over, because we've had a lot of problems. We haven't had really actual club meetings in quite a while right now because of the situation we have with Floyd Bennett. So that there's been a lot of issues with our club, the KCRC. Many people have called and asked, you know, where you guys are meeting and why not. And, well, you know, in the whole business we've been going through, we can't seem to be able to put down some roots right now. Floyd Bennett is definitely out for who knows how long. And, in fact, we had a sort of a discussion today on 10 meters about the future. And so far, like I say, we haven't had anything concrete. So I know there's a number of issues. So I don't rely much on the the club anymore for anything other than still a member, but we're sort of, as they say, diversified or just all over the place. We do not have a formal club right now, Dick. Over.
Understanding, that makes sense. That was a beautiful location you guys have had that you've been using for your June VHF contest site at Floyd Benz Field at the the Blank Visitor Center. All of a sudden, I can't say it again.
Ryan Visitor Center.
Right, Ryan Visitor Center. I couldn't think of the Ryan name. And that was a beautiful setup you've got. And so once they're finished doing that renovation, if you're allowed back in there, that's a really great location. Okay, do a quick look and see if you've got one or two or three emails that you think would be exciting to go to. In the meantime, let me pick up with Paul and find out what's the latest going on in space. The couple of websites that I visited from NASA led me to believe that they did get a very nice signature, not as bright as they expected, but a very nice signature when they crashed those two craft into the, I think it's the South Pole crater of the moon, looking for water. And they haven't made the official pronouncement yet. They're being super conservative, and they want to see whether or not the water does exist on the moon. You might have some later information on that, Paul. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I've seen the picture that was released, and it very, very looks very small in the picture, but you can see a glow from the small area from the part of the crater that the Centaur booster crashed into. Picture taken from the LCROSS satellite, which crashed into the moon 4 minutes afterwards, and then that was taken. You know, they took pictures of that as well from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, 30 to 50 miles above the lunar surface. And that's what I've seen, you know, the same picture as you. And they say that's about a mile above the surface, what you're looking at there. So, there you go. Like you said, a couple of weeks probably before final answers come out. They're doing our evaluations of all the different wavelengths of light that they took pictures in, you know, including infrared and ultraviolet and all. They want to see what, you know, what they have, and then they'll make a final determination, and they'll release that on the NASA website first. Very good, Dick. One comment I want to make, let me drop it, was about the Ares 1X rocket that's going to be launched on the 27th of this month. So that'll be news, because that'll be the first official launch of anything that's to do with the new Constellation program, which is the concerns a group of different rockets that will be put together for future manned missions. The Ares 1 rocket will carry the people up. Eventually you'll see an Ares 5 launch that will be using an external tank that the shuttle uses. I mean, that's years down the road. Now I'll have two solid boosters attached to it. It'll kind of look like the shuttle without a shuttle. It'll have just a cargo payload on top. So you'll have the Ares 1 for manned missions to launch the Orion spacecraft, which will carry up to six astronauts, and then you'll have the Ares 5 with the external tank and two solid boosters for the heavy lift vehicle for all payloads that'll be going either to the space station or to the moon or even to Mars. And on that heavy lift vehicle you would have the lander, and I think they're calling that Antares. It's the first lunar name for the lander. Let me drop a WS to it. It's So that's really the only thing I had for a space report. Looking forward to that launch from Florida on the 27th. The Tuesday, it'll be from 8 o'clock in the morning till 12 o'clock noon. That's the window that they plan on launching. There was a leak in the system recently, but they fixed that, a nitrogen leak around down by the cone, bottom of the rocket. But otherwise, everything seems to be going good. I got everything put together, almost ready to go. And should be fun to watch that. Just wanted to ask you a question about something that's been on TV the last couple of days. This character that put a balloon up in Colorado, Fort Collins, Colorado. He launched this balloon and told everybody his kid was on there. He came out with a report when he was telling the cops. He said, this thing could be steered with 1 million volts across it. And I was wondering about that one little comment. So I looked on the internet, and there was some guy that came out with information about this guy. Apparently he must have worked for him at one time. And he did talk about this propulsion system that he was trying to develop. Let me drop it. And it was called the Byfield Brown effect. I wonder if you've heard of that, Dick. Supposed to be, you could either use kilovolts, or in his case he was going to use megavolts of, they never said what, you know. There's some references to it on the internet. Sounds like the corona effect that you would get around an antenna. So that's the reason I thought it might be good to ask. And this guy apparently was going to try to use this for some kind of propulsion. He's some kind of an amateur scientist, or he claims to be anyway, but what he is now is in a lot of trouble, because the news has reported that they're about, you know, a day away from probably being arrested for creating a hoax. So I was interested in this Byfield Brown effect. Have you heard of that? WS.
I think I have not. But now I'm sitting here thinking, is there a way that you could electrostatically power air molecules and get thrust out of it, a small amount of thrust? It's kind of difficult, but I think it's possible. The trouble is, ordinary air molecules are not polarized. But if you pass them across a high voltage circuit, you could get some ionization. When you arc over air, you're creating a plasma. A plasma is a charged cloud of air molecules. And could you use that for propulsion? I think it's possible. To do things like that in a vacuum with ionic propulsion is reasonably well known. To do it without a vacuum, I think, is kind of difficult. So I remain skeptical. I'm not so sure he's got a working propulsion system, and even if he does, can he get enough thrust out of it to do what he desires? That craft looks to me like it was much too small in overall volume to be able to support a child. So for him to, in the beginning, claim that his child was on board sounds to me like he knew there was a hoax going on. As a balloon, that was nowhere near big enough to support a child and the life support system for the child. So, and this guy has been on television before in a sensationalistic manner. And there is some evidence that he was seeking publicity. So I think there's a fair amount of chance that he's in trouble for creating this hoax, that in the beginning he knew his child wasn't there. And quite possibly he was telling the child to hide. The child seems to have a mixed story as to what he was doing, why he was doing it, and so on. Let's see now, there was another subject I wanted to discuss with you. something to do with space. Let me drop.
WB2CUK with a question for you, Vic.
Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, I've been listening to the mail here. I heard you mention the IEEE, and for the life of me, I guess I should look on the web, but are they still holding the little annual or semi-annual conventions? I used to have them at the Javits Center and at some other places. I wonder if they still have their little their meetings where they hand out samples and you meet with engineers and all the companies. I haven't been to one of those in years. I'd like to get back into it.
Yeah, it used to be held at the Coliseum in New York City way back in the early days. It used to be called in the very beginning it was called the IRE show, and then it became the IEEE show. And they filled up three floors of the Coliseum. I wouldn't call it little. I think they had numbers like 50,000 attendees and hundreds and hundreds of illustrators, of vendors. Is the IEEE holding conferences and shows? Absolutely. In various places around the world. Boston, Philadelphia, Miami, Los Angeles, Chicago, Dallas. Various different shows for various separate sections of the IEEE, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. Now, they're still holding the great big show in New York City, is what you're asking. And I think the answer might be no. I don't remember a major IEEE show in New York City in the last couple of years. The David Sarnoff Center in Philadelphia, a number of other places. Possibly they've discovered that New York City is too expensive, and maybe they haven't gone back to New York City anymore. That's just a pure guess on my part. So are they holding shows? Lots of them. Are they holding them in New York City? Maybe not, if I don't remember seeing one. Now, there are IEEE-sponsored events on individual subjects being held from time to time at Telephonics Corporation, NADA, BAE, which used to be called the Hazeltine. You'll have individual shows from the Antennas and Propagation Society, the Microwave and Technique Society, the Aeronautics Society, and so on, at those individual places. So from time to time, there's about six or seven of those shows, I wouldn't call it a show, six or seven of those meetings on an individual subject each year on Long Island. Back to you, Bill. W2CUK, K2RIW.
W2EAV.
Ed recognized, but Bill first. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dick. Yeah, that's what I kind of figured. I think they've had him at the Edison Center at Edison, the convention center there, I think I've seen. But I've been out of touch, and I used to get tickets where I used to work. They used to have the tickets, and I enjoyed going. It was a lot of fun. I'll turn it over to Ed, and I'm going to sign. I'm playing with the computer and watching the Phillies clean up on Los Angeles tonight. That's about it. Ed, over to you, and thanks for the information that WB2CUK is going to be clear.
And Ed, anything you can do to make your signal a little bit louder will help. You were a little bit noisy on that last one. EAV, RIW.
Heck of a lot I can do out here with the HT, but I'll give it I'll do it again. They called that, started calling that show the Electro Show. Then they started holding it in New Jersey. And then I think it moved to Boston or Philadelphia or alternate between the two, leaving us in the lurch. Walking with the wind in my face regarding a conversation of a couple of minutes ago, if you want to have a balloon thruster, you're going to have to generate some real thrust out of the wind that I have in my face. Dick?
Very fine, Ed. You seem to be confirming what I thought, that major shows in New York City seems to be absent for the last few years. Places like Philly and Boston are where they're going instead. I'm guessing those cities are making the IEEE a better deal, and maybe New York City is too expensive. New York City certainly has the draw. I mean, you and I have attended past IEEE shows in New York City where many thousands of attendees were there. So it isn't that the problem that New York City doesn't have the draw. There must be some other impediment as to why the IEEE hasn't used New York City and why they're using these other cities. And Now, when it comes to thrusting for a balloon, and the balloon is large enough to give you the right amount of lift for a human being, and the propulsion system to keep it aloft, and the propulsion system to move it, these are all very difficult things to do. And I'm kind of skeptical that this guy in Colorado claims to have a working system that did all that. So what I'm hearing leads me to believe that he's in a fair amount of trouble as to what he claimed and what was the reality. I back you any further comments on that, Ed. WB2EAV, K2LIW.
No, not that.
Okay, you found a very good location on that transmission. Put an X on the mark in the ground in that spot. Okay. We've had our space report. We've heard from Ed. Back to Mel. Let's see if he's found an interesting piece of email that we should be addressing. And I will be resending you that Lansdorfer article, because I think it's a kind of a good one, Mel. One way or the other. If worse comes to worse, I'll make you a hard copy and mail it to you by the snail mail. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yep, this is K2KEY. I think a few years ago we had a similar problem. I tried to also that time email you some information or some formulation on a system, and it just didn't go right, so I made a hard copy, I could say, and sent it to you. You remember by snail mail that time, and then we were able to discuss it because we couldn't seem to, you know, actually visualize both ways what was going on. So it's, I don't remember what subject. Well, I think it was a mathematical formulation for some kind of antenna system. All right, yeah, as far as the IEEE, one quickie on that. I used to be a member of it. Used to go to all those conventions there at the Coliseum and all. In fact, I used to pick up your book, your favorite book, Topics in Electronics there. I'm sure you remember that from AIL. And then all of a sudden, they stopped even with the renewal applications to the IEEE. And I don't know. It's like they just disappeared. And I just forgot it also, because we used to get, you know, the yearly applications. I put my name in on it and send them the dues and whatnot. And even that ceased. And they used to have a booth there where I used to go over to. That represent the IEEE, and I don't understand what happened that they just, like, abandoned New York completely, considering what used to go on that Coliseum. It was packed with people. I would bet it was the most popular one of their shows. Over.
I agree with you. I think there are four floors to the IEEE, to the Coliseum in New York City, right near Central Park, the southern end of Central Park, and I think there are times when the IEEE filled up at least three floors and sometimes four floors. Filled up the whole damn building with vendors and various lectures and whatever. In fact, I've even given some lectures in the Coliseum in New York City for the IEEE way back in the dark ages of, 1978 or so, 1974, 75. I gave a lecture on the subject of ratiometry antenna range setups, which was an IEEE article. So they've lost the recipe as I see it, Mel. And yes, I do remember you and I had some trouble mailing things back and forth. So there's a degree of incompatibility with our system. I got to bring that to the attention of my son, who is the computer maven in the house, and we'll eventually straighten that out. I'll do a conversion of the document to PDF, and very few people have trouble getting proper viewing of a PDF once they can open one of those. So I'll resend it to you. Back to you for an email if you think you got a good one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Got several of them here. Okay, I could say we'll give it another try. And yeah, I remember that Coliseum. Yep, all four floors. When the old Coliseum existed, all four floors there were taken up, plus the mezzanines. I mean, they jammed everything in there. You couldn't, you know, see the whole show in one day, and I could say, and attend the different talks that they were giving. So I used to always wind up with doing that at least a few days. In fact, I'd make sure that was my time off, my vacation time, part of it. I would take off those few days because I enjoyed that that shows so much. I can't imagine why they couldn't come into places like the Javits Center, which has all kinds of shows, boat shows, car shows, this shows and that, that they knew the drawer that they couldn't, you know, possibly understand that New York City was an important place to have a show because people were coming in from all over. You know, it's easy access to our airports and plenty of hotels and whatnot. So I'm real surprised that they didn't continue with it. Okay, I'm just looking now at something. Oh, yeah, one of the things that generated a number of comments, that is the November issue, over.
Okay, you had a little bit of drop out. You said one of the things that brought up comments was the November issue. Okay? I think the November issue of QST has just come out, and I've cracked it, but I haven't read all the articles yet. Back to you, Mel.
Start timing out. That's why I jammed the last word in. The November issue, look at, if you have it in front of you, page 64. This is what is generating a lot of controversy. You know, you always hear, put the antenna up as high as you can. And according to, a few people asked me, they said, according to the article here, putting these towers up 100 feet and more in the air with your 20-meter beam on it may not be the ideal way to go. A lot of confusion. I thought maybe you perused over the article and give me your what you think of their work that they conducted as far as antenna height, Dick, over.
Okay. If you can talk for about 30 seconds on any subject you like, I'll go in the other room and get my November issue and look at page 76. Back to you, Mel.
All port on.
Okay. No, it's page 64, experiment number 82, antenna height. Let me see. Let me let it drop and see if we've got anybody that would like to join us via one of the other modes while you're getting QST. This is K2KEY, and this is the TechNet.
Hey, Mel, WS2N.
Okay, go ahead, Paul.
Good evening to you. Did you see page 72 in the same article, same book, about the long delayed echo of about 80 meters? I read that one. I didn't read the one you're talking about. I read the one about the echo. That sounds kind of strange. I wonder if you saw that one.
Oh, this is not new. It was an experiment we talked about that was conducted some years ago, and they had long echoes on 80 meters that were heard hours later. One said that they claimed and they documented it. I forgot where it was that they did a documentation, and they found something like 24-hour delay. And, you know, it sounds mind-boggling how this could happen at all on 80 meters. But I have heard this before. This is not the first time, Paul, that people have said that they all of a sudden heard their signal coming back. They thought it was coming back from the moon, the way it was the delay over.
I know. I don't know where it's coming from. I mean, this guy, well, he documented it, but I don't know. I thought it sounded kind of far-fetched. I had to check to make sure this wasn't like an April issue that I was reading that I got, you know, in the mail by mistake or something. But this is a treaty on that. Now, he was hearing it, but the guy he was talking to on CW, the other guy didn't hear anything, but this guy did, so... I guess if he didn't break out his computer and hook it into his audio card, it could have been just a tall tale. But you know, he's got everything here. So I thought that was pretty amazing. But all right, I'll turn it back to you, Mel. I'm sure Dick is back by now. Back to you, Mel. Love you.
At 8 o'clock. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
KC2 QAQ with comment.
Okay, go ahead.
Net time complete.
Just on the topic of hearing echoes, I've had this experience. I haven't heard this in a while since the sunspot activity has been kind of low, but there have been opportunities where on certain bands, if I turn my beam into the long path to a DX station, and I'm just listening. Sometimes what I can do is hear